It's 1 o'clock and time for your appointment with the Reluctant Therapist.
Good afternoon. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I'm glad you're here and found the show with us today at our new time, 1 p.m. Change is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because you can prepare for it, and you can know that it's coming, and then the change happens, and you still have to go through the reimagining of your life or the restructuring of your habits and your routines and the things that you have relied on to be consistent at the same time every day or every week. And for almost 18 years, I've tuned on or been introduced at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And that consistency of coming in to the studio and seeing the people that I work with and coming into my spot and my special chair and getting settled in and kind of hearing that introduction of it's 2 o'clock, time for the Reluctant Therapist, was this sense of identity and comfort and how my life worked. And I've been off for the summer, and so today is my first day back in the studio in quite a while, and the change has been loud in a really quiet way, because to come into the studio, to come into this familiar place at a different time, have to get used to that. That feels different and settling into my space. But also the quiet of the hallways, the quiet of my entrance in, because Hank Hadley isn't here today. And that's a big change for me, for the station, for people that have been a part of the life of KCBX for 30 plus years, know the voice of Hank Hadley. And to be honest, I didn't know how anything would hit me because I haven't been here all summer, but the emptiness is large and the silence is deafening, and I miss him. Hank Hadley, wonderful man, good hugs. But it's also one of the reasons I'm back here today and wanted to be in the studio to talk about grief and that empty space that we have to contend with when someone leaves our life. I was thinking about James Hillman, who kind of the founding father of archetypal psychology and imaginal psychotherapy. And he lived to a ripe old age. And at some point he said, you know, if you are lucky enough, fortunate enough to live long enough, you will be grieving the loss of those who have been a part of your life as much as you're enjoying the rest of your day-to-day life, the idea that you get to be here. He said, to live to this old age, I now have lost almost or more people that I know today. I have lost and said goodbye to more people. And the grief is visceral. It's there all the time because grief becomes an embodied experience. We can't just think our way through grief and say, I feel sad and now I'll move forward. Our whole body, our soul gets encapsulated in those feelings of grief and need to be able to work it out. And so James Hillman said, part of my life, along with my meditative practice and my yoga practice and my social practices is now also a grief practice that is part of my day to day, that I need to make time for that grief practice every day to honor those feelings that move through me. Sometimes they are overwhelming and some days they are fleeting, but I need to make time every day to have a ritual of grief so that it doesn't overwhelm me and become chaotic. Because having that specified time to grieve and to sit with the losses and to think of those that we love gives our psyche a chance and a time and a place to process those grief feelings, to move them through, to make space in that once empty space, either for new feelings or to come to peace with the feelings of loss. I've been thinking a lot about that the last few weeks, about that grieving ritual and the importance of having a grieving practice. I don't know if I'm old enough to have lost as many people as I know. That's not true. But grief is not just about losing people. Grief is also about changes in who we are and changes in our life and changes to change the world around us. The changes in our ecosystem and our environment can cause great senses of grief and sadness and loss for people. We can grieve, you know, leaving an area that we loved and wanting to be back there, but circumstances change. And grief has two components to it, there's many types, but two components that we can mostly relate to. One is that personal loss, and that is private grief. When we lose someone who's close to us and has meaning in our life that may not have that same impact to everyone we know in our life or day to day or someone that we work with, they can't experience that private grief with us, except they might have had their own losses and understand their own unique feeling. But when we lose someone who's close and to us, to our heart, to our day to day, part of our story that we're in. When a character or a piece of that story is gone, that is a private grief that we work through. But then there's the public grief, the public loss. Dolly Parton. She touched people around the world in unique and personal ways, but in a public way that we all can tap into and understand. You can say Dolly Parton and people, oh, yes, and nod and feel that, whatever their feelings for her were. And what's interesting about public loss is it connects us, whereas personal loss is private and can feel isolating and we can feel like we're turning inward, which is part of the process. But a public loss of someone like Dolly Parton becomes a connecting place for us as people, that we can look at strangers and have a Dolly Parton moment and nod and kind of share that sense of communal grief. And that's a really important part of how we as a civilization create unity, especially in a time where we're so fractured and at odds and not agreeing about anything. But then Dolly Parton leaves us. And then there's that moment for connection. And I don't know how long it goes on, but it's visceral right now. I'm feeling it everywhere around me, as I'm sure you are as well. And you have an opportunity to put down your arms, whether they're metaphorical or physical, put them down and have this be like, wow, that was, what a great person. How she changed so many lives. How she was able to bring goodness to the planet with really no seemingly other agenda. And of course, Dolly Parton had her private life, but her public life, her Dolly Parton life, touched people in a way that made it feel safe to be soft and tender right now. At a time when most of us are living with our guard up, but losing Dolly Parton and being able to share that public grief, that collective mourning, that sense of loss of goodness in the world, we share that together and it helps us tap into each other's hearts. And oh man, we can really use the feeling of each other's hearts right now. So I've been thinking a lot about that as well. Again, I don't know how long this moment lasts, but if we allow ourselves to crack open our hearts or put down our armor or whatever it is we've been using to protect ourselves from pain or sadness or frustration at this moment, to just sink into this communal and collective loss of someone like Dolly Parton, and to be able to breathe together and realize at the end of the day, almost all of us just want to feel goodness and love and feel connected. And then feel grateful that there are people that can come into our lives and through our lives that can fill that space in our heart. And that it's so important that we have moments and opportunities to allow our heart to open up, because it's also easy to have a hardened heart because pain and sadness and grief is scary. And it's very tempting to close our hearts and not want to feel anything and just kind of be Teflon and move on through. But then life is a different shade, isn't it, when we have closed our heart? And I only say that because since I've been in town, everything has a different shade to it right now. It feels electric. It feels more raw and real, and I feel more present, so present. And so today, I am here because I wanted to open up the phone lines and talk about grief and those places in our hearts that sometimes get ripped apart. And how do we cope with that? How do we move forward? How do we deal with goodbyes, forever goodbyes? And can there be good grief? Can grief be good for us? I would posit that it is. It's one of the most universal experiences we'll have as human beings, is shared grief, personal and public. So I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and you're welcome to be part of our show today by giving us a call at 805-781-3715. You can also find me on Facebook and Instagram, and I have a post up today. I know I'm not great at doing them, but today I have a post up, and you're welcome to leave a message to me there as well, or send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com after the show as well. We're going to take a break, listen to a favorite of Hank Hadley's, and come back and open up the phone lines and talk about grief. Anything you'd like to share? Where is your heart? Is it open? Is it closed? Are you willing to open that heart today? And I'm going to talk about some grieving rituals and grieving practices that you might find helpful in your own life and maybe sharing with those you love. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And thanks for finding us today, our new time, 1 to 2 p.m. on Tuesdays, to share a conversation. And today, we're going to talk about grief and what that looks like. And again, as I mentioned, grief is a private thing. It's very unique. There is not a one-size-fits-all way to do grief. There's not a blue ribbon at the end of the process if you do it correctly. People have their own journeys and feelings with it. We all have our own temperament. But back in 1969, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, a psychiatrist, developed 5 stages of grief that originally she noticed in terminal patients, people who were going through the process of dying, and she recognized that they went through these stages on their way to passing. And then she also started to recognize and realize that the families and those close to the person who was dying were experiencing the same stages as well. And so these stages of grief, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, created a structure for grief that brought this sense of structure, foundation to a chaotic time. And there has been different models of the stages of grief throughout the years, 1969, but the most recognizable are these 5 stages, and how by at least having an understanding that the body and the soul and the psyche move through these stages, that it's not forever, it's not infinite, that grief changes and transforms and becomes incorporated into us. So we're going to talk a bit about those 5 stages of grief and how we see them. I've also opened up the phone lines, and our number is 805-781-3875. So we're going to get started there with Melanie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. What's on your mind today?
So it's a very interesting topic that you bring up, and one that, unfortunately for me, is pretty close to home. I mean, I'm 65 years old, and I have suffered a lot of loss and a lot of grief in my life. But one of the things that you kind of covered some of the things that I was thinking about, which is how it can unite us when you lose someone like a public figure, Dolly Parton or Ozzy Osbourne or a sports mm-hmm. figure. You know, these things do tend to unite us. But I was thinking about that. But I was also thinking about how sometimes grief serves us in a weird way. So for instance, I lost my mom back in 2000. Mm. And we were very, very close. And here we are 26 years later. And I still think of her every day, and I miss her every day. Mm-hmm. And there are some days that are easier than others. So even 26 years later, the pain can come right to the surface.
Yes.
And it's something that they don't explain well, I guess, in our culture, is that grief is something that can also help kind of help you remember. And it's not that you don't remember the people that are gone, but through that grieving process, to still feel sad that somebody is gone is to feel close to them in a way, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not distant, you know. It's not like, oh, yes, you know, I lost that person 20 years ago and I barely think of them. It's like when I think of a couple of the people, use my mom as best example, but when I have somebody like, then that still hurts. Mm-hmm. That grief is horrible, but at the same time, it does serve to bring those memories and keep me closer. Does that make sense? It seems kind of weird, but that's a thought that had gone through my head.
No, I absolutely appreciate it, Melanie, because it was one of my notes to remember to share that one of the things I work with my clients, my students, is this idea that our grief is evidence of the depth and meaning of our relationships. And so to reframe that pain and that sadness to what an honor it was to love someone so much that my grief is so deep.
Oh, I like that. I like that. That's a good way to put it, because it's been something that's rattled around in my head for a very, very long time.
Absolutely. And it sounds like you've allowed yourself to hold that space and tap into that love and let it live in that place. And in the grief has a different meaning, because it really is love. You know, grief is love. And
well, yeah.
And it's less.
And I think, if we didn't love someone, we wouldn't grieve them. It's really true. So we hear, you know, random things that happen around the world. We can't stop and feel that deep sadness for every person that occurs on the planet. We would go crazy.
We would.
You know, it would be way, way, way too overwhelming. It's overwhelming enough when it's people that we love and know.
Absolutely. And so as you're working, all of us, when we're working through the process of grieving someone, if we could flip what that definition of grief is to actually being love, it allows us to not feel so afraid of grief, because there's a lot of cultural fear around the process of grieving and the chaos of it and the sense of being so lost. But if we allowed ourselves to say, I am loving someone who has passed, I am actively loving them, and that process of loving them brings up a lot of feelings. And those things, again, are the gifts, because I wouldn't want to spend my life not feeling anything.
Well, thank you for putting it in those terms. That yes, thank you so much, because that, yes, that is so true what you're saying, but I didn't know how to articulate it really, so...
I appreciate you.
That's really a beautiful way of saying it and to think of it.
Thank you.
And, you know, I appreciate that a lot.
I appreciate you calling in and kicking us off today. I didn't know where the conversation was went, but I saw a phone call pop up, and I thought, okay, today's going to be all right. So, Melanie, I appreciate that from you.
Well, thank you so much, and I'll hang up now and continue listening.
All right, thank you. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and our number is 805-781-3875. And I think we have Bree on the line.
Hi. Hi, Elizabeth. This is Bree Zender. Do you remember me from like 10 years ago? I used to work at KCDX.
Well, absolutely, because you produced my show with me for a while. So
I
can picture you through the window.
I'm just calling in. You know, I've moved on from Gix. I've lived in a bunch of different parts of the country, and I just wanted to come and remember Hank. I haven't had a chance to talk with anybody who really knows him, because I live in Washington State now, my home state. I don't have the people to remember Hank with. And, you know, he was just one of those people who, in radio, you need to have people who you can trust and have a steady hand and are just calm. And, like, Hank was the definition of that.
Mm. Well, and it's interesting how people touch our lives at different times. You know, we think that it's fleeting, but then something comes up and those relationships, those people who touched us, they stay with us. It's like they find a place in our heart and they kind of attach and go on the rest of the journey with us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I just wanted to send my love to everyone at the station and everyone who loved and knew Hank.
Oh, well, and I wish you the best, Bree, because I follow you a little bit on socials and see that you've created a whole family.
Yeah, definitely. I'm in Washington now. I'm working at my hometown newspaper and producing events. So, yeah, a lot of fun.
Well, thank you.
I'm with KCBX in Flo in the Central Coast.
Thank you so much for taking the time to call, and I wish you the best.
Same to you.
Bye, Bree.
Bye now.
One of the things that is challenging when it comes to grief is where do we put the feelings? You know, how do we reach out? Who do we talk to? When someone dies, do we send them a text or do we rip on Facebook, which is one of my least favorite ways of remembering someone. It feels so cliche and callous. But aside from that, you know, that comes up a lot with, you know, clients and with students and with friends. Like, what do we do? I feel nervous. I don't want to make the person sad who's grieving, right? I don't know how to express what I'm feeling, but I feel like I need to say something or do something. And in talking about Dolly Parton and public grieving, you see that people come out with flowers who weren't in her inner circle, but they go to her state. They want to feel close. They want to have this opportunity to express, like, I want you to know what you meant to me. And I don't know the best way to do that. And the simplest way is when it's a private loss, it's a personal loss, and someone's having their private grieving experience. If you knew the person who passed away well, and I always encourage people to handwrite notes. No emails, no texts. Handwrite notes, and don't get a card. Although Hallmark makes them, they're not personal. They're very cliche, and we want to avoid cliches because it minimizes the depth and importance of the loss that someone's feeling. And so we want to handwrite something to let the person know, I sat with the thoughts and memories of your loved one. And if you knew them well, you can tell a story, something that stood out for you, something that they did, an anecdote. Or if you didn't know the person who died, but you're good friends with the person who's suffering the loss, maybe they lost their mother, still write them a handwritten note and just say, I didn't know your mother, but I know how much she meant to you. I know how much you talked about your relationship. And it doesn't have to be long. That's enough. And then the note gets sent and it gets held. One of my closest friends lost her mom and dad close back to back. And it's been, I think, 3 or 4 years since her mom passed. And she told me the other day that she just started reading the notes and letters that people sent and that they're giving her such comfort 3 years later. Because if you've been through the loss, the death of a close loved one, the beginning, that first year, the second year is actually busy because you have to clean up this person's life and kind of put it into order. And so your grief and shock and overwhelm of losing them is mixed into all of the business of being alive and going through their files and going through their statements and closing things down. And so that overwhelm doesn't give you a chance to really settle into the feeling, the real deepness of, oh, there is an empty space. Because people talk about how that first year you go into kind of a bubble of shock. And then you're just kind of sleepwalking through that loss, that experience, because you're doing a memorial service and you're dealing with shutting down their life. And it's kind of busy. And you don't really have time to experience the depth of it. And then year two, generally, of grieving is harder than year one, which people don't want to hear and hate to hear. But it's actually true, because the first year, you're so busy, you're just surviving. In year two, things get quieter and people stop coming around as much or asking you how you're doing. And the reality of the loss of this person becomes really visceral. And then you start opening up to those feelings and that empty space that you have. And the pain quite often is too great to want to read notes of condolence or to reach out to other people. But as my friend recognized, like by year three and four, you start to, you've recreated what your narrative looks like, how this person fits. And she said reading, there was about 100, her mom had been a school teacher, so there was 150, 200 notes. And she said reading them allowed her to open up her heart and her feelings, and the grief could come out and flow and flow and flow. And she said, I was having a really hard time expressing the grief I was feeling because it felt like it had been 3 years, and why am I still feeling this way? And just like Melanie said, it's been 26 years, why am I still feeling this way? So she felt a little strange feeling like this grief still needed to be experienced, and having those cards and letters helped her move into that space. So that just affirms my feeling I've had all along that the handwritten note, no matter how short or how deep, is really helpful in the process of grieving for those that are experiencing that loss. The piece of that private loss and the idea of how do I fill that empty space that this person once occupied in whatever way, if it's a spouse and the day-to-dayness of their physicality in your life is unimaginable, or a parent who has been there your entire life and just the consistency of knowing, I'm going to call mom this week, or we're going to, you know, see each other at Christmas, just that part of this person being in your life in how you visualize your calendar as the year goes on, or it's friends, whoever that person is, they've held a space in the story you've created of who you are. Because we really are just an assortment of stories of who we are. We create that world. And so the people that inhabit our stories, when they leave, when we've said the forever goodbye, we have to reimagine that story without them in there regularly. And so how do we do that? How do we make that change? And as I mentioned with Melanie, one is how do we reform the idea of grief as, yes, it's incredibly painful, but that pain is indicative of the depth of our love. And then what do I do with that love? Because the person's not there to shower that love on anymore. I can't hug them, feel them, do things for them. And the love is still there when someone dies. We don't lose that feeling of love, that active verb of love. So how do I transform that? Some people find, you know, volunteering or taking on projects or having a memory book or creating a bench that they can go sit on, like all those ways help them to actively continue to love that person. But then you find that active loving of them in different ways. People talk to their loved ones who have passed. People sit in quiet places and feel their presence and maybe ask them questions. And I don't know where the person is, probably inside the heart of the one who's missing them, but they can still conjure that love and feel that actively. And that's one of the reasons why people tend to be hesitant to go through the stages of grief, because the fear is if I go through these stages of grief at the end, I've forgotten the person, or at the end of the grieving, I need to let them go as if they never existed. But that's not true. The five stages of grief are the process of helping us rewrite our story and create a different space for the person we've lost in our life. If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and the phone lines are open. I'm here to talk about your heart and your grief and your feelings and your experiences. What are your tricks, if it's a trick, or what are your rituals around grief? What are the things that you have done or found to be comforting when you've lost someone? How are you doing with that day to day? The idea of James Hillman that I brought up at the beginning of the show, that we come to a point in our life where we need to create a grief practice, like we have a yoga practice or a meditative practice, this grief practice, where we take the time each day or once a week to allow our psyche to process loss. I'm curious to know your feeling about all of it. Our number is 805-781-3875. We take a quick break and continue our conversation and take your calls right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
to me? Has he been good to you? Has he been everything that you expected it to be? Was it as good for you as it was good for me? And was it everything that it was all set up to be? Now is that gratitude? Ooh, now is that gratitude?
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And one of the things that I've found is a great part of my grieving practice is music, that I can conjure those I love through the music that they loved and the music that they found meaningful or that we shared together. And I've found that to find that crying space, if I want to release, I can feel if I've been holding a lot of tension or maybe pushing things down or pushing it aside and not making time to feel the feelings. The right song can be my vehicle into a grieving moment to allow the expression of the feelings. And it's usually a song that might surprise you. Like, there are some classic sad songs that people listen to that help to bring those emotions to the surface. But sometimes it's a song that might be silly or that might have been from, you know, a time that you just were laughing really hard that you wouldn't think would bring up the grief, but that it allows the opening of that space. Because we're so conditioned in our culture to keep that private grieving super private, so much so that we bury it inside of ourselves and stop forgetting to allow it to come to the surface. 805-781-3875 is our number. And Deidre, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. I just want to just add a little to what you had said before.
Mm-hmm.
If I may, it's when we grieve people, they're not always deceased. Sometimes we have a lifelong relationship with someone and things happen and either party and they separate.
Yes.
That's also a grief.
Yes.
That I think could be walked through using the same steps. I just wanted to add that. Thank you.
No, I appreciate it. Deidre, thank you for calling. You know, it's almost like we have rules around what's okay to grieve and what things we shouldn't grieve. And sometimes the loss of a relationship, a friendship, or a family member through, you know, not being able to connect, you almost feel like you can't grieve that because they're not dead, but that hole exists in your heart, right?
Right, exactly.
And it sounds like you've experienced that, and I'm wondering how you've felt or dealt with that sense of loss.
It's not a matter of self, it's a matter of feeling. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really good that we have programs like this that just bring everything out in the open so other people can know that they're not alone.
Yes.
And that grief is debilitating and it sometimes can be very destructive.
Yes.
So I think to find support, and that's really hard. Because as you get older, the cognitive ability of people that were older than you, now has changed their whole cognitive outlook. And I just think that it is important to talk with people and try to get out there in any way, shape, or form as much as you can, because you're not alone. And so that's all I need to say.
Thank you, Deidre. Thank you for taking the time to call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
where do we go when we're grieving? We know that there's hospice, and we know that there are counseling services that are available to help people who are going through the grieving process, but not everyone finds them with to be comforting as we hope they're going to be. And also, when we're grieving, quite often our first thought is, oh, I don't want to burden other people with my sadness, because it's so overwhelming to me that I don't know how I can share that with someone else. And yet, and I think Deidre was kind of alluding to that, that if someone reaches out to us, we want, as kind of in our human nature, to be able to be there for people. When someone loses someone they're close to, our first thought is, what can I do? What can I do to help? But unfortunately, when someone's in that space of grief, they can't tell you what they need to help. And this is another part of the grief practices that I wanted to share, was what can you do? Well, we're going to write a letter. We're going to write a note. But then also, we're going to do something without being asked. I'm not going to impose ourselves on the person, but, you know, we have a tradition of dropping off meals. That's a very a strong part of our cultural way of reaching out. We're going to bring a meal. But maybe we do some gardening for the person, you know, head over and clean up the yard, or without asking for thanks and not asking them to come out, but just quiet things that we can do to just touch in and let the person know that we're watching out for you. But then to also say, you know, I know that you're dealing with a lot of grief, and I'm happy to listen. Or just sit in silence with you if that's helpful. Because the grieving person, quite often, again, doesn't want to burden other people. Sometimes they don't want to open that door because it feels so overwhelming. But to be invited to share how they're feeling can be such a relief. And for many people, the fear is, if I say, how are you doing? Or I miss whoever it was that they lost. Or I imagine that you're feeling really sad, and how are you feeling? Their fear is that the personal start talking and sharing, and that they won't know what to do. But here's the secret of counseling. You don't have to do anything. Really good counseling doesn't involve anything more than respecting the person's story and hearing it. One of the great mistakes people make in life, and it's with a great heart that they do this, but it's a great mistake, is they feel like they always have to have an answer, or they always have to give you advice, or tell you what you should do, or here's what I think would be helpful. And none of those things really help people. And so in counseling, we rarely, if ever, give any advice. We listen and we respect the space, and then we respond back to the person with, I hear the sadness in your voice. I see the pain in your eyes. I hear how upset you are. We just honor that we heard and listened to what they said without feeling like we had to fix it or make it better or heal them. Because that puts a lot of pressure on someone to feel like they not need to all of a sudden feel better because you're listening to them. No, that's not my expectation. I never expect someone to talk to me and then say, oh good, I'm all better now. I just am a moment. I'm a moment in their life as a therapist or as a mother or a grandmother or a friend. I'm a moment in other people's lives. But that moment can oftentimes help in a way that the person can take a breath. And then maybe they feel more open to talk to someone else. They feel a little lighter. That's all we can really offer to any other human being. And when we think our job is to give someone an answer or advice or what they should do, we're really just pushing them further away, because none of us want to be told what to do. Let's be honest. And so if you want to be really present for someone in a time that they're really struggling, have the courage to go to them and say, I'll be quiet with you, or I'll listen to you, but I'm here. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and if you're just tuning in, our number is 805-781-3875. We started off today talking about grief and loss, personal loss, which is private, when we lose someone that's close to us in our life and maybe wasn't related to all the people we know. That private, personal loss can feel very isolating, very silent, very alone. And then there are public losses when someone like Dolly Parton passes away. Then we have this cultural experience of loving someone who brought good to the world and gives us a moment to pause and connect to each other. Even if we don't agree about anything else, we have this moment of public loss that allows us to share a broken heart. And when we share in that grief as a community, it makes us all feel less stressed, less alone, less isolated, and that the people around us don't feel like strangers, but they feel like other human beings that are moving through their lives as we're moving through ours, just trying to figure it out all the time. And that's what we're doing. We're always just trying to figure it out all the time. Our number is 805-781-3875. Michelle, I'm so glad you called. Thanks for taking
the
time. It's nice to hear from you.
Nice to hear your voice, and thanks for taking on this topic that takes way more than an hour.
I agree.
I think just a couple of really comments based on my own experience, based on the experience of my family. One of the things that I remember stood out to me after my stepdad died many, many, many years ago, my mom said that one of the hardest times was after all the, you know, there's a lot of focus when the person dies and maybe there's a service or a memorial or people are coming by with food, all of that. It was probably maybe 4 to 6 months later where there was a great deal of loneliness because the activity around the loss had happened. And that's, it makes sense. Of course, people are going to move forward, go on with their lives. It's not the same as a wife. But as we think about reaching out to people that we love or being one of those people that needs that love, just something to remember that it's it definitely is a long process as well.
Much longer than we're really allowed to experience in our modern culture, you know. And in the psychotherapy world, they actually created a diagnosis during COVID, right after COVID, called prolonged grief disorder. And those who wrote...
There we are.
Those who wrote the Diagnostic Statistical Manual in Psychotherapeutic World decided that 1 year was the appropriate amount of grieving time, and that if people were still in deep, deep grief after a year, that it would be considered a disordered response that could require medication or psychotherapy. And that really has been a splinter in the psychotherapeutic field, because there's a lot of clinicians that say grief is not a one-year experience. If you were married to someone for 60 years, you are going to be in deep, deep grief probably for the rest of your life. And I think that's part of the challenge is we don't, there are no guidelines for correct grief because it doesn't exist. And so that's what makes it really a challenge moving forward is how often do we check in with the person? Should we continue calling them? And I don't want to bring it up if they're not, you know, sad. Yeah. We don't know how long to keep checking in.
Yeah. Well, I think, that makes sense to me, right? And like you said, everybody's an individual and we all have our own process and biology and temperament and all the things that go into being human. And of course, that's also going to happen when we are experiencing loss.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I'm glad you called. I appreciate that. And I like the reminders of, you know, all of us, almost anyone who's of middle age, we'll go there, I'll be kind. From midlife for on, we can assume that all of us are carrying griefs with us. And that at most any time of the day, if you turned and hugged one of your friends that you love, it covers the basis of, we're always going through feelings of joy, but also grief. And in this moment, I'm giving you a grief hug. If you're feeling it or not, just to know I'm here.
Yeah. Yeah. When you lose somebody, there are those things that just stay with you forever. Mm-hmm. I mean, my stepdad died 35, 6 years ago. So it was a long time ago, and I'm not in low grief at all. I remember all of the wonderful things about him, and
yes,
and the things that remind me of him that happen really almost on a daily basis, little tiny quirky things.
They're still alive in you, which is why I mentioned that if we transform that grief, which is kind of the goal of going through the stages, the grief becomes loving and the love just changes. Instead of actively with the person in person, that love finds a new way of expressing itself. And for you, it's in the memories of the things that he did, that every time you tap that memory, that's that love that still exists, is still alive.
Right.
I appreciate you calling in.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Thanks for what you do.
Thanks, Michelle. Take care. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. So if you're not familiar with the five stages of grief, they are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. That denial piece is usually our instant reaction because the psyche can't handle the shock of if it's a death you were not expecting. And then there are the deaths that when we know someone is dying and they're in the active dying stages. And again, that denial might be a shorter period of time because they are still there. You know that they are actively dying. But if someone dies unexpectedly, the denial can last a bit longer. But it's that sense of, oh, this couldn't have happened. I must have dreamt it, or this not, something's going to change or a miracle happen. And then when the denial starts to transform and the reality of the person's death is in your face, and anger usually follows. And the challenging part of that anger is quite often you're angry at the person who died. Why did you do this to me? How could you leave me? Why were you so reckless? Why didn't you take better care of yourself? And then that anger can turn into yourself. Why didn't I do anything? Why wasn't I more helpful? Why didn't I spend more time with this person? And so that anger phase can actually hang on for quite a while. It's a defense mechanism. It protects us. Sometimes anger can protect us from feeling great grief and sadness inside because it's external. I'm mad at the doctors, and I'm angry at the universe, and I'm angry at God, and I'm angry all the way around. And then there's the bargaining piece. It's like, you know, I will go, this is a classic one, I will go to church every day for the rest of my life if you'll bring the person back, or if you'll make sure that they don't die, or that they somehow have a miraculous recovery, and that we start doing these bargaining things with the universe or with ourselves or just in general. But the bargaining doesn't usually last very long, and it slips from bargaining back into anger, because you're realizing you're not going to get your bargain, your wish, your desire. So the anger emerges again. But anger can only sustain for so long. It's exhausting to be in a state of anger, isn't it? It's just exhausting to feel wronged and forgotten or not. The anger is really exhausting. And so what follows anger is depression. And that's the anger turned inward. And the depression piece of grief is really important if you think about what depression looks like. Not depression in the clinical form of, you know, manic depression or chronic depressive disorder, but depression that is actually protective. Because depression itself isn't necessarily a bad thing. The psyche uses depression to protect us. It almost encompasses us. It gives us this time period to kind of become a cocoon. Think about if you looked at the definition of depression, a depression is a kind of a rut, right? If you're going along a road and you come upon a depression, it's a rut in the road. So if you're feeling depression, it's basically like you've gone into a hollow, that you're being held in this depression in the earth. And that space now allows you to process quietly. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's harmful. Now, having said that, depression that gets stuck can be harmful. Because grief is fluid, it moves, it's not stagnant. And when we get stuck, when we stop moving, eating, bathing, you know, interacting with people for too long a period of time, that becomes destructive. That is dangerous. That's where our community of people keep an eye out for us. to make sure if we're in our depression, cocooning, that we're still eating and getting up or, you know, getting into bed or getting out of our pajamas. Like just moving enough so that the grief can move. Depression that's immobile starts to create deep problems. But depression in its on its own is not a negative. It's important. There's periods of time in our life, even not just around death, that we need to go quiet and go into a depression space where we can cocoon ourselves and think our thoughts and move through to whatever's coming next. So we shouldn't always look at depression immediately as bad. It's important in this process. But as we move through the depression, things start to get a little lighter. That you don't wake up in the morning and the first thought is the person who died. That you'll maybe go until noon and not think about them every second. Or maybe you've gone through an entire day. And then there's that confusion of, I didn't think about my person for an entire day. What's wrong with me? So there's that kind of moving through depression and moving back out into light. And the last phase of our grieving is acceptance. And that part is what kind of scares people. Because if I accept that my person died, then that means they don't exist anymore. So there can be some resistance to moving to acceptance. But real acceptance in a healthy grieving process, and there are healthy grieving processes. There's not one way to do it, but there are healthier grieving processes and unhealthier grieving processes. Drinking our way through the first year would be an unhealthy grieving process. Exercising for 7 hours a day would be an unhealthy grieving process. We don't want to Forrest Gump our way through grieving processes running across the country. But some people, that might be their only way of surviving, having said that. Experiencing death is experiencing chaos. Your life becomes chaos because when we are in relationship in our lives, in our narrative of our life, we create what's called a homeostasis. And that homeostasis is where just things make sense. Even if your lifestyle isn't incredibly healthy, you can create a homeostasis in that lifestyle. It's what's familiar. It's a security blanket of I know what to expect every day. When someone dies, our homeostasis blows up. And we feel off balance, dizzy, out of sorts, confused. Imagine when your life gets tilted. Or if the earth gets knocked off its axis, that's what happens when someone dies, when things change. We go through periods when we break up with someone. We have to recreate our world to rebalance our life in a way that makes sense again. So it's normal to feel out of sorts, dizzy, confused, overwhelmed, chaotic. So part of the process of going through these stages and having our grieving practice and giving us a time of day to grieve and saying to our psyche every day, from 4 to 6, I'm going to allow grief to come on in, but I need to be able to work through my day, the rest of it. You start to set up these spaces that create structure again, and the acceptance comes in, and you can breathe differently, and you carry this loss in a different place in your heart. It doesn't go away. It just finds a different place, and then we figure out that we can move forward, and that we end up carrying a lot of pieces of people that we loved with us for the rest of our life. And again, instead of it feeling like baggage, it feels like richness. Like Michelle said, you remember the quirky things or little songs that they liked or things that they did. They fill our lives with richness, with light. And that's a healthy, good grief. To remember someone and the first thought is, oh, I miss them. And the second thought was, oh my gosh, they were so great. That first thought is, oh, I'll never get to do that with them again. And the second thought was, they introduced me to this and I love it. And that's good grief. It's the tinge of sadness followed by that feeling of joy. I knew them and they changed me. And I carry that with me. And that's good grief. I think about that with Hank, coming back and doing radio after so long and being in the space and there's just this person who's kind of rock solid and you figure, well, if all else fails, if I go off the air or I pass out behind the microphone, there's someone there to catch me and to make sure we stay on the air and we keep moving forward. And that's the beauty of allowing our hearts to be open and taking chances in creating relationships, because we may lose them, and that pain is immeasurable, but at the same time, we knew them, and it changed our life and made it really pleasurable. And I think that's what it's all about. Dolly Parton touched us in ways that we just have to look at each other and maybe hear 9 to 5 or hear one of her songs, Islands in the Stream, which wasn't my favorite, but I can hear it and I can picture her and I smile inside. And it's like, oh, goodness exists in really fun and eccentric ways. And I want to continue with that. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can always send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com or send me a message on Facebook or Instagram. You can podcast our show to share it with others or listen at any time through Spotify, NPR Podcasts, Apple Podcasts. And you can listen to previous shows at our archives at kcbx.org. As always, it's a privilege to sit in this chair and get to speak to you every week, Tuesdays at 1. And thank you for listening and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Down there, I hear that it's cold way down there, yeah, crazy.